Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a wonderful show for you this evening. Aviation educator and YouTube star Martin Pauly is here, and I just love the work that he does and cannot wait to talk to you and have him explain all his story and so many other things that he is busy doing. Before we get started, just a few things that are going on. First of all, as fall approaches, as the end of summer happens, I can't believe I'm saying that, but as we start rolling into that, Social Flight is just chock full of new events and destinations and cool things happening. So be sure to go to socialflight.com or get the free Social Flight mobile app for Apple and Android devices. We have tens of thousands of aviation events, destinations, so many cool things in there. We've got courses that you can take for Wings Credit in our FAA Learning Center. If you're a mechanic, we have AMT courses for their awards program. And if you're a mechanic with an inspection authorization, you can get your 8 hours of continuing education directly through Social Flight with legal certificates for your renewal. It's all here. It's all free to you, sponsored by the folks behind me on this board. And it's really a wonderful thing to check it out. So be sure to do that. And we have our Fly to Win Challenge. We just gave away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument glass for your panel to our winner, Pat Doyle from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And we have a new challenge going on right now. We're giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset on October 1st. Now, all you need to do if you want to enter to win is simply get the Social Flight app and just check in at any airport nearby. Even if you check in only once, you'll be entered in to win. And if you check in at multiple airports, do a whole bunch of flying, which is the whole purpose of the Fly to Win Challenge, you can compete to be on our leaderboard and get extra entries, increasing your chances to win. It's all there in Social Flight. So we're just here to support general aviation, and we appreciate you doing the same. Tonight's broadcast is brought to you by Avidyne and the amazing IFD 550, 540, and 440 series of navigators and the new Avidyne Vantage system that is literally going to revolutionize so many Cirrus aircraft panels out there. The IFD 550 and 440 is a combination that we use in our Bonanza. If you've watched our videos of traveling around the United States, doing lots of cool things. And we are also putting an Avidyne 550 in that Mustang getting built right here behind me. And that even includes a camera that is a taxi camera, and all of that is a part of the 550's functionalities. So it is very, very cool. Be sure to check that out. Now, on to tonight's guest. Martin Pauly is a longtime pilot and aviation YouTube personality, best known for his ride-along approach to demonstrating real flying in the real world to tens of thousands of viewers. In addition to his day job as an aerospace strategist for a commercial avionics company, Martin is a commercial airplane pilot and flight instructor with a passion to share his 40 years of flying with both aspiring and experienced pilots from around the world. His 1978 Beechcraft A36 Bonanza, November 70 Tango Bravo, is one of the best known Bonanzas on YouTube. It takes Martin and his family on adventures across most of the United States, and his unique goal is to land his Bonanza at every Class Bravo airport in the United States, and he is well on his way towards that goal, and he's making a video of every single one of those trips. I am absolutely thrilled to have him here with us tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Martin Pauly. Hey, Martin, how are you doing this evening?
Hi, Jeff, I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you so, so much for taking time to join us here on Social Flight Live. I have been both a friend and a fan for so long, and I have to say, Your trips, your approach to what you do on YouTube is so unique. I really, really love it. And we'll get into how you do it and some of that a little later in the show. But I want to start by first saying thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the nice welcome.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you kind of got to where you are today. But let's start with what got you into airplanes? What was the story there?
Yeah, what got me into airplanes? The earliest memories I can remember are revolving around two things. One is our next door neighbor growing up in a home in Germany where I was born and raised. Our next door neighbor was an airline captain. And the very first flight that I remember ever taking was a vacation trip from Germany to Greece. And for that trip to Athens, I was in the jump seat of an L-1011 as I think it was an 8-year-old at the time. And that was just mesmerizing and inspiring and awesome and a lot more things that must have left an impact. And I remember many, many conversations with our neighbor. He probably got tired of me coming over and quizzing him on all things airplanes.
How old were you when that happened?
I must have been around 8 years old on that trip. So elementary school age. Yeah.
I want to pause there for a minute because there is something we lost about this time when the flight deck door was open and you used to be able to do things like that. So you got to go and jump seat the entire flight in an L-1011. That's amazing.
It is. I mean, I know it's very restrictive in the U.S. It's still a little easier outside of our country here, like in Europe. If you know someone or if you have a professional reason to ride along, it can be arranged more easily. But you can learn so much from watching a professional fly crew interact and conduct a flight. In addition to planting the seed for a young person to become a pilot and pick it up.
It's wonderful. And I think even with the restrictions we have today, I think more and more people should encourage the kids before the flight takes off to go up there and visit the cockpit. So tell me more. I had to interject there just because I missed that idea of the open cockpit so much. And I love the idea of you jump seating, but please go ahead.
Yeah, so that was the first ingredient. The second ingredient was that an uncle on my dad's side of the family was, in his younger years, a pilot himself. He had flown airplanes and gliders. Flying gliders is very popular in Germany. And that led to many family conversations between him and me about flying. Long story short, when I was 14 years old, which was the minimum age to fly gliders in Germany, I joined a flying club not far from where we lived, and have been flying ever since. And my uncle too started flying again a little later. He visited about a year ago here in the U.S. and I took him on a trip for about a week. Through the Midwest, we visited an air show. We visited the Air Force Museum in Dayton, Ohio, and did a lot of things. And it was so nice to show him, what had become out of that little seed that he planted decades ago.
That's wonderful. I love that. And tell me a little bit about what influence you believe that gliders played in your flying, because I feel like so many people have said how valuable that is, and yet I don't have any glider experience. I feel like I should. What? Tell me a little bit about that.
There are a few things I can think of, and I think anything you learn in a glider transfers in a positive way to flying airplanes. You certainly get an appreciation for flying the aircraft cleanly with the ball centered, so to speak, or the yaw string all straight, right? Because if you don't, then your sink rate is higher, and that's bad. That means the flight is over sooner. You don't glide as far. So aerodynamics and an understanding of weather is a lot more important than when you learn to fly airplanes, and these things help then later on when you fly airplanes. certainly the use of the rudder for entering a coordinated turn, right, is you can't do it in the glider without it. The adverse yaw, because of the long wingspan, is so significant that if you move the aileron to the right, the nose will go to the left if you don't also put right rudder in, more so than in any airplane that I've flown. So maybe another thing I would add is the it's somewhat routine, you know, not desirable, but somewhat routine to land off airport in the glider. So, because if we fly cross country, we have to make an educated guess as to where the next thermals can be found, where we can find lift again, because the glider always descends, right? It's only in rising air, when the air is rising faster than the glider is descending naturally, that we can actually gain altitude. And the altimeter is our fuel gauge in a glider. So when the fuel is up, right, when that altitude is used, then we have no choice but to land, you know, at whatever is below us. And it's a lot more common in the glider than in airplanes. And almost all the time, nothing bad happens. You know, we call the rescue team, and they come with these long, skinny trailers. The glider gets disassembled, put in the trailer, and it's more routine. And you know, that doesn't guarantee a good outcome if I would have an engine failure in an airplane, but it maybe helps a little bit with the anxiety, right? And also with planning and always looking out, and you're looking for fields for suitable areas, maybe changing course a little bit to make sure we stay over friendly terrain. You know, that's second nature to a glider pilot, certainly helpful to a pilot of a single engine airplane as well.
That I can really relate to that. I mean, it makes sense. There's so much time, especially here in the Northeast where I'm based, there's lots and lots of trees and lots and lots of hills. And so looking for spots that you could put down has a pretty profound meaning in a single engine aircraft. But I didn't realize that it was quite as commonplace as you're describing to land off airport or on a glider. I always thought, boy, these guys are really, really good at timing it. Like for all these, always landing on the runway and always landing exactly the way they want to. That's impressive. And it never occurred to me about, you know, going cross country or doing anything else that might take you into a farmer's field or something like that. I guess you get really good at talking to farmers.
You do. Yes. And you figure out what's important to them. You know, we had insurance coverage that would cover, you know, any actual damage that occurred, which, you know, in a glider, you can't really do that much damage to a farm field, but they authorized us. It was very interesting. They authorized us to pay in cash up to 100 Deutschmarks, about 50 bucks, right there on the spot, as long as the farmer agreed that would be the end of it and no further claims would be made. And almost always, the farmer was happy to take those 100 Deutschmarks, you know, sign the form, and be done. And it was quick, it was relatively cheap, and well, what did we really damage, right? A little area of crops, or usually nothing bad.
I love that. I want one of those forms for everywhere, for like in my car, if I stumble on anybody, if I land off field, like here's whatever this thing is, sign this and we're done. That's really cool.
Yeah, so, when they had to wait, you know, get some money quickly, or go through a lengthy process, you know, document it, have the adjuster out there. No, almost everyone took the quick money.
Especially since all you did is, you know, saw down a couple of kernels of corn, ears of corn.
Right.
So take me from there. How did you then transition from what we'll call relatively inexpensive glider flying into powered aircraft?
Sure. Yeah, that still happened in Germany. When I was in college, I went to the University of Aachen and studied computer science there. At that time, towards the end of my college, I had saved up some money to get my airplane single engine land rating, or the equivalent there in Germany, with the anticipation that, you know, after college I would have a job with some regular income, and I could hopefully afford the more expensive way of flying, in Germany at least, of flying airplanes. And I think the timing for that was okay. My first job out of college was in southern Germany, in a town called Ulm. It's about halfway between Stuttgart and
I don't think I
Munich.
Could pronounce that one if I tried.
it's ULM. There's a new Ulm in Minnesota here, not far from where I live. Ulm in southern Germany. Anyway, I got a job there right out of college, and about a half hour drive from there was a small airport called Biberach, and that's a harder name to pronounce. There I flew both gliders and airplanes, more extensively airplanes than I had before, because, well, now I had a job, I had an income, and I could afford to make those payments to get the plane. And did my first international trips, which from Germany isn't as big of a deal as it is from the US. I mean, you fly 2 hours in any direction and it is an international trip. Had a lot of fun doing that. And about 1 year later, my career brought me to the United States. I accepted a job offer here in Iowa, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, from an avionics company for what I thought was going to be 1 year. Well, here we are 26 years later, and I'm still working at the same company and have been working in different roles. But the company's been great. My personal life here developed wonderfully. But one thing that certainly contributed to my desire to stay here was just how easy, how simple, how useful and pragmatic and affordable general aviation is in the United States, compared with what I was used to. And I know if I had stayed in Germany, I likely wouldn't be able to afford a Bonanza and likely wouldn't be able to fly an airplane for transportation and pleasure like I do here in the US.
That's wonderful. I think it's so important that people appreciate the uniqueness of general aviation within the United States. It's just very, very unique, and it's more affordable than even our neighbors to the north in Canada that are very, very close. It's more affordable than pretty much anywhere else. It really is wonderful that it's possible, even though it is hard to describe it as affordable. But at the same time, it still brings it within reach and supplies the future of pilots and the future of aviation for the entire world.
Absolutely, yeah. And I give AOPA a lot of credit for getting us here and keeping us here as much as possible. You mentioned it's hard to think of it as affordable here, and yes, it's not the cheapest hobby you can have. That's correct, and it's like many other things, it's getting more expensive. And at the same time, anyone who has never tried GA abroad, if you are on a trip, a work trip or vacation trip, just talk to pilots there about what it takes to fly somewhere, what difficulties they face, and I think you'll all agree that it's I call the United States paradise on earth for general aviation, and I don't think that would happen without AOPA, because there are a lot of forces that want to do other things with a nice real estate that we use for airports than letting us fly.
Exactly. Yeah. As the saying always goes, every realtor is telling every homeowner that's near an airport that don't worry, the airport's about to close. Don't worry about all those airplane noises. We're getting close to doing that. So tell me a little bit about your flying in the United States and what got you to the point of owning the aircraft that you've got right now, 70 Tango Bravo.
Yeah, when I started flying here, I was renting planes from an FBO and joined a flying club. Our company actually has a flying club. At the time, they had three airplanes. Right now, they're down to two, an Archer, sorry, an Arrow and a 172. And I flew the Arrow a lot. I later joined a different partnership on the field with an Arrow, nine people sharing one Piper Arrow. And liked that plane a lot. Did a lot of trips all over the eastern United States, all the way to the Denver area. But over time, my life changed. I arrived here single. Now I'm married. We have three girls, and we wanted to be able to take trips as a family in the plane. So we needed something with more than four seats. And after looking at Piper six-seaters for a while, Lancers or Saratogas, that seemed to be the natural step up from an Arrow, somebody said, "Hey, you should look at an A36 Bonanza. You might like that." And I did. I looked at an A36 and quickly fell in love with it. And between the looks and the handling characteristics and the build quality, and last but not least, the camaraderie between Beechcraft owners. They all seem to love the airplanes. They're proud of it. We help each other out. It's a stronger community than I had seen between other type clubs or pilots flying other types of airplanes. So all of that turned out wonderfully, and I acquired November 70 Tango Bravo 12 years ago in 2012, and have been its caretaker since then, and I hope I'll fly it for a long, long time. It's been a great plane
Not a
for us.
bad time to buy an airplane.
No, it was from a market perspective. I'm not an expert when it comes to airplane pricing and how that develops. But yes, 2012 was a great time to buy an airplane. The airplane is worth a lot more today, in part because of upgrades I made to the engine and the avionics, and just put air conditioning in it. So every year, every couple of years, we try to make it a little nicer than it was. But also the market, as Jeff, has changed quite a lot, right? And it's not really all good. I mean, it's nice to look at a number, but then I have to provide hull insurance for that higher number, right? And that costs more. And I wish airplanes were as affordable as they were 10, 12 years ago, because then more people, especially more young people, could afford to buy these nice airplanes and get into aviation the same way that that you and I did. Because ultimately we need more young people in this hobby here. If the pilot community ages too much, or the airplane owner community ages too much, and that's not good, because ultimately we need to keep the fleet flying and keep the infrastructure alive that way.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that's a very profound thought that I think it's a shame, really, that the market has gone up so much. I'm not someone that looks at it and says, hey, this is so great. I won because the plane went up 300%. I think that's actually sad. I wish it hadn't. I really wish I bought my plane back in 2010, the one that we have right now, the Bonanza. And honestly, I wish it were worth the same thing that we paid for it, because that would mean that anyone else could still be, it could still be in the range. And if not that, then so many other planes could still be within the range for so many other people. And that's what we need. I mean,
Yes.
I don't want this to be an investment vehicle. I want to keep it. I want to keep it in the family. I just want them all to be available to everyone as reasonably as possible. And that way my kids and my kids' kids and everybody else and all the friends and people we meet can have aspirations that are very achievable to own these aircraft. And so that's a really good point. And I like that you brought that up.
The saddest thing in this context that I've seen is, now I've seen this with a couple of friends, is that they had an airplane that they loved and had owned for a long time. And in both cases, they sold the plane over the last couple of years. Why? Because they feared that, you know, they were at a tipping point where the value would decline, and they said, well, financially, it's the right thing to do. Mm. And, you know, otherwise they would have kept flying this plane for many more years. And yeah, there's a downside of those rising values.
Yeah, that's interesting, because again, I you always used to talk about it decades ago, always, that like, well, a plane's a good investment because it's going to go up a little bit. It's going to, you know, protect your investment instead of depreciate. But the idea that we start looking at it only as an investment and then looking to liquidate it because of trying to predict its peak is a shame, because it's about flying.
Yes.
So back to flying, tell me, what got you into being a YouTuber? So you went out, you found November 70 Tango Bravo, and fell in love with it, as everyone does with all the aircraft that they have. Mm-hmm. And so tell me about how this flipped over into all of a sudden doing the YouTube thing.
Yeah. The way that happened is, about a little over a year after I got November 7's Tango Bravo, I felt that I was really comfortable in it and could handle it pretty well. And a dream that I've had for a long time was to fly in my own airplane to Chicago O'Hare, the international airport in Chicago. Why? I don't know. I have this weird addiction or obsession that I love these big, busy airports.
It's that first flight. It's that L-1011. You want to be in that cockpit, maybe. That L-1011 down there. You're like, hey, I own my own now. I want to see all the lights, not just a couple.
Jeff, you might be onto something. Maybe that's still in my memory and triggering this. So anyway, two things happened in preparation for this flight to Chicago here. One is a good friend and coworker who's also a pilot came along for this flight. His name is Rob, and you know, Rob and I prepared for this, and a few days before the flight, Rob showed up in my office and showed me something, a little gadget that I'd never seen before. He said, "Martin, this is a GoPro." Said, "What's a GoPro,
you're,
Rob?"
You're dating
said,
yourself.
"It's a little camera." And he said, maybe we can take it with us on the flight and record it and turn it into a little video. And that brings me to the second thing, that in preparation for this, I had done web searches in on Google or in flying forums to help me understand what is it like to take a small piston airplane to a large airport like Chicago or here, right? What do you need to know? Am I even ready for it? So I thought, maybe I'm not the only one with that question. You know, maybe other people would try this if they could have an idea of what it's like. And so the idea of bringing a camera with me seemed great, not just to create a memory for ourselves, but to share this with others. And that's what we did. You're looking back, it was a really bad video compared with the ones I made later, because it was so long, right? I didn't know yet what to leave in there and what to cut out to keep the pace going. But some people liked it. And a few weeks after I published it on YouTube, you know, Rob stopped by again and said, "Did you see that it has 1,000 views?" And that was a big number, you know, back then when it all started. And that's how the channel started in the fall of 2013. In fact, you know, just a few months ago, it was the 10th anniversary of the channel. It was specifically to share that experience of flying to a large airport in hopes that seeing that would be useful for somebody else. You know, and since then, I've added a bunch more Bravo airports to it. I'm somewhere between one third and one half down the list of Bravo airports in the US. So still quite a few to go, and I hope to check at least a couple of boxes here yet this summer and fall. And then there were other topics, other kinds of videos, you know, some educational, some more entertaining. As you mentioned in the introduction, a lot of just plain IFR flying, right? This is how you fly IFR in the real world, right? Because the flight training for the instrument rating, while important, is really not a very good preparation for real instrument flying in the national airspace later on. So I hope that by sharing these flights, people can see and learn, oh, this is what it's like to fly on a nice weather day. This is what it's like to fly on a really crappy day. And this is what it's like to get a clearance at an uncontrolled airport. And you name it, right? There's so many scenarios, so many tools available. Mm. And, I've you know, picked up a bunch of things here over my almost 40 years of flying, and I really like that YouTube gives me a way to share that with many other pilots, in addition to the one-on-one instruction that I also do and that I also enjoy.
That's one of the things that I appreciate the most out of the work that you do, and I would encourage everyone to go check that out on your YouTube channel. And it's I do love going into the, you know, major airports and you do some of those other things. But the big thing that seems to be missing from flight training from many people, whether it's your primary training or whether it's, you know, secondary training such as your IFR, is really understanding how to do it in the real world. Really understanding what a flight entails and what happens during a normal flight, because there's only so much, you know, that really gets done in the flight training, where you start after years, you start to understand, oh, okay, these are situations where I can predict what a route is going to be and I know I'm going to get it. And, or you can be like me up here in Boston, where you sit there and you throw your hands up in the air. And at this point, you just go, this is where I'm starting, this is where I'm ending, because they're going to give me their route anyway.
Right. Yeah.
I'll direct and let them tell you what you're going to do.
Right. Yeah. One of my favorite examples is that, you know, from instrument flight training, I don't know how anyone could pass the check right and go through all the flight training and not assume that every instrument flight ends with an instrument approach, because that's all we do, right? Instrument approaches left and right. And every time we touch the runway, we do it after an instrument approach. And then after you get your rating, you know where I'm going, right?
Yes.
An instrument approach is the exception, not the rule. It's usually visual, or you cancel before getting there.
I find it the other way around. If you file an IFR and you plan on doing an IFR approach, you are pretty much guaranteed you'll be doing VFR approach. If you file VFR and you plan on doing a VFR flight the entire way, you will end up filing and doing an IFR approach.
That can happen, yes.
So tell me a little bit about one of the things that's very cool is that when you take people along with you through the video, you edit together this story of a trip and you show everything. You pop things up on the screen. You show what, you know, exactly is being said and what you're actually filing. And you do a lot of very, very helpful things that prevent. There's never that moment of, wait, what did they say? Or what is actually happening? You're really explaining what's happening. How do you do that? How did that evolve?
Yeah, evolve is a good word, because I didn't do any of that in that first video that we talked about, right? And for the first Chicago O'Hare flight, that happened gradually over time. And I think it started with the closed caption where I said, or it was comments from people that say, man, I wish there were closed captions for ATC because sometimes they're really hard to understand. I thought, well, that's a good idea. And then I did that for a video and got really good feedback because sometimes it's hard, even for us in the cockpit to understand what exactly ATC is saying. And it's easy to imagine that for somebody who isn't used to listening to these transmissions, it's even harder. So I've gotten a lot of feedback that is helpful. It's time consuming and it takes quite a bit of work to put that on the screen for every transmission, and then hopefully don't have a typo in there, which of course sometimes there still happens. So that was the first thing, and then other elements include maps, whether it's a sectional chart or an airport diagram with an airport symbol that gets animated to show, okay, we get a taxi instruction, but put it in context, right? Where are we and what does this instruction mean? So I've looked for several different ways to illustrate what is being said, either by the controller or by me during these videos, so that people who are learning to fly or people who might not be pilots and have no interest in being a pilot, but are just interested in learning about our world can comprehend more about what they're seeing there, instead of just hearing a few sound bites and then that's it. The more people really understand what's going on when they see my videos, the better I feel I've done my job.
How does it change the way that you fly? The fact that you're making videos about H1, what does that do to compare to, I mean, do you take any flights that you don't record?
I take a lot of flights that I don't record. When I'm going on a flight, I look at what that flight is, and if it's something that I've already recorded a few times, why make a fourth or fifth flight over the same route if there's not something special happening that day, maybe weather-wise or so. And sometimes I'm sorry.
So are those radically different flights then? I mean, do you things very differently when you are producing a video out of it versus?
No, not at all. In fact, my goal is to completely ignore the cameras, to the point where if I could, I wish I could forget that they're even running, because I don't want the cameras to be a distraction. Thinking of an analogy, I remember a DPE once telling me when I talked to him about check ride preparation for one of my students, he said, one of the things that I hate hearing from students is I only did that because it was a check ride. And then they go out of their routine, out of their comfort zone, because they want to do it extra good. And fly every day like it's a check ride. So in the same sense, I take flying seriously, and I don't want to have a different approach for flying with cameras on versus cameras off. The only thing that might be different is that I talk a little more, as if the camera were a student and I'm explaining what I'm going through. I still talk to myself even when I'm by myself, when I'm the only person on the plane. I believe that helps. Verbally saying things or reading checklist items out aloud and not just pointing at things that keeps more of the brain engaged, and that's a good thing from a human factors perspective. But no, other than that, I'm a pilot at that point, not a video producer, right? And if because otherwise the cameras would be distracting, and flying is serious business and it requires my attention.
That makes sense. But I did always wonder if when you were on your own and not making it, if you talk as much.
Probably a little less, right? But if you and I were flying together, you'd probably you'd probably hear me say much of the same things that you've seen me say in the videos. You know, it's just for awareness, for sharing what I'm doing and why, and maybe soliciting some ideas from you or whoever's sitting in the right seat. I talk.
Do you look for IMC days to go flying? Is that something where when the weather's good for IMC, it's not, you know, do you look at that and go, this is a great day to fly?
Yes, absolutely. I do it for fun. I do it for, you know, for currency, you know, because in my regular flying, low IMC is pretty rare here where I live. So there's not a whole lot of you know, real instrument approaches, loggable instrument approaches that I do. So I need to fly for currency. But thirdly, I do it for training. When I have an instrument student and the right day is there with conditions where an actual instrument approach may be ending with somewhat lower visibility, you know, maybe a mile or a little less. I think those are great conditions for training because, again, back to our earlier point of preparing students for really flying the system, right? The foggles or hood just don't do that. They go from you see nothing to unlimited visibility, right? And days like that certainly exist. Sometimes we have an overcast at 500 feet and or 200 feet, and when we break out, we have perfect visibility. But flying for the first time an approach and breaking out at minimums or slightly above, and then having only a half mile visibility for the first time, that can be pretty intimidating and surprising.
Oh yeah.
And so I, as much as I can, I like to make sure that that my instrument students have experienced that with me, you know, before they do it for the first time. And you know, more and more we hear about flight schools, especially Part 141 flight schools, that for insurance reasons are not allowed to fly and train in IMC. And I, that is a thing. they only do the foggles, and I can understand why the insurance company likes that, you know. But at the same time, I don't think it's a great service for the students, because then they will sooner or later find themselves in the clouds and in the low visibility after breaking out of the clouds, and they could be better prepared if they had done that with an instructor.
Oh yeah, I didn't know that was really even a thing, but that scares the heck out of me. That I definitely don't like that. I mean, when I think of the kind of times that were really challenging or like got my nerves up, it would be like first solo, and then and then way beyond that in its level of stress would be the first time that I flew solo and climbed into the clouds hand flying with my instrument ticket.
Right.
That was nerve-wracking. I knew it was just me. I knew I was staring at the instruments. I knew what to do, but that's scary. When you know, and
absolutely,
part of that is depending on how much time you really have of doing it with an instructor beside you, I suppose, really lessens that. And I can't imagine that having someone's first time in IMC for real being like alone.
Yeah. When I did my instrument rating, the instructor that I did my training with was extremely helpful with those kinds of things, with your real life scenarios. He had flown for many years and did some freight runs here and there, so he knew how to work the system and was instructing on the side out of a passion. That wasn't his main job, but he also looked for weather conditions that were helpful for someone like me to learn. I really appreciate that looking back, what he did, and I try to do the same thing, you know. And it doesn't always work out based on my availability and the student's availability and the airplane's availability, right? And the weather can't be too bad. It has to be the right level of difficulty for where the student is. But yes, I do look for IMC conditions, and I fly. And you know, back to currency, when I haven't done this in a while, and I hand fly an approach, I can tell that I'm a little rusty, right? Not to the point where it's dangerous, but certainly to the point where I'm not too pleased with how well I can keep the plane on the final approach course and the glide path or glide slope. And then the second is a little better, and by the third time I'm usually happy with the results again. So I try to not let too much time pass between doing that, because I can very much feel just how perishable that skill is.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second, because, you know, I think it's an interesting balance that I would like your perspective on, between flying routinely or and really knowing how to properly use your autopilot versus the hand flying side of it. And I feel like there's different approaches to it, but not a lot of them seem as logical or as comfortable as I wish they were. Because there's people who are like, oh, you just have to know how to hand fly stuff. There's others that really have to do with using the equipment. But in the we're talking about the real world, and a lot of what you're flying is about the real world and the real system. And in the real system, you're actually going to be a lot safer using an autopilot, but being extremely ready for when you have to depart from that. So how does that factor into how you teach and what your experience is?
So I'll start with the experience, that because I resonate very much with how you just described it, Jeff, right? The single pilot IFR is high workload, and you being able to rely on a good autopilot that you understand and that doesn't let you down is so helpful. You can think of that autopilot then as the pilot flying, and you become the pilot monitoring, which gives you time for other things, and frees up your brain to do radio communications, navigation, etc. But as you said, you have to be ready at any moment to act and intervene if what the autopilot is doing isn't right, or if you programmed it incorrectly, or that can happen too. And that means that it both are important, right? You need to train, and I train regularly flying with the autopilot approaches and other things, but also hand fly, because they're equally important. And then there is a third one, a hybrid, if you will, use of the flight director, where the autopilot brain, if you will, the autopilot computer is doing all its magic and guiding the plane, but it's not actually using the servos to execute that those turns and pitch changes, but it's showing you guidance cues in the attitude indicator that you simply follow, and it helps you perfectly intercept a final approach course, or perfectly fly the racetrack pattern of a hold, so that it's timed right, and that can be very helpful. Flight director, I think, is an underutilized tool. You know, most people that have one in a light single engine airplane don't really use it, or sometimes don't really understand it. You know, airline world or jet world is a different story. Flight director is a more of a known entity there and more appreciated.
It seems to me that you know, I've had instructors that focused on, you know, make sure you know your autopilot. I've had instructors that focused on, you know, you're not going to use it. We're just going to go out there and you're going to fly the whole hold yourself. You're going to fly everything yourself. Those, neither one of those situations just seems all that realistic to things that I think have come up in my real world flying, which have usually been using the autopilot, and then, as you mentioned, for either a fault with the autopilot, let's say, or more often it's a fault with the pilot, and it all of a sudden you're in that situation where hold on a second, it's not doing what I thought it would be doing. It's not starting its descent. Why is it not starting its descent? And it's something like that, where that seems like the missing training. Like, that's the part where it's like, no, this is the real world. This is what you got to be prepared for. You're monitoring. It's not doing what you want. Now you got to take over.
Yeah. And what you just mentioned, excuse me, the descent, it reminds me that a thing that I find somewhat routinely in training is that pilots, owners of airplanes, have some muscle memory for how to use the autopilot, but it's not always correct. They might forget the last step that actually starts the change. And what I see, and I've sometimes found that with myself, is that it's so easy to go through the muscle memory and then sit back and think that we're starting the descent now, right? Because I just told the autopilot to do that. So ending any kind of autopilot interaction with a verification step, you're looking at the altimeter and the vertical speed, saying, okay, descent is starting. I'm happy with how that's working, right? Only then can I take a break. But I think that's really important, and that's probably the if we could all fix that, that would get rid of, I think, most of the autopilot issues that I've seen people have.
Yeah, sometimes it's that, and sometimes it's I know it's happened with me. It's misunderstanding a type of approach and what's actually programmed in there to do. You know, where you're following one type of approach and it'll do that. And then another type of approach, you're not getting the guidance you think you are between these two waypoints to start down. And there's just a lot to learn, a lot to stay on top of, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And in a way, our marvels of technology today make it harder for somebody to learn instrument flying, right? Because it used to be just an ILS and a VOR, and if you maybe an NDB, and that's all you had to juggle. Autopilot was either not in the trainer or wasn't working, so it was all hand flown.
Definitely wasn't working.
and while it seems almost cruel looking back, say, what, you had no moving map, you had no help from automation, right? The flip side is there was only one way that we had to learn to do things, and that's a lot harder today, right? The many ways in which we can program an autopilot or fly an approach with either GPS guidance or ground-based guidance and switching between those modes, it's not exactly trivial to do all that.
No. And every single plane is different. As you mentioned, the trainers, the autopilots don't work. And then everything else that's out there, can be all modern. Or in many cases, like ours, it can be a combination of an autopilot from 1975 and avionics from very recently. And you just have to learn how it all works to make all that happen. Let's talk about your panel for a second here in the time that we have. I've got a few pictures. This is you with that beautiful aircraft. And a few pictures of that, but this is your panel, and I want to focus mainly on the left-hand side, right in front of the pilot here. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Aspen. Got Aspen two displays in front of me. You've got three. Tell me about flying with the Aspen.
Yeah, that's been a really great experience for me. And maybe a word on the history of the panel. You know, why is there such a mix of equipment? The one piece in there that's the oldest in my panel is the engine monitor from JPI. I've had that longer than anything else that you see here, other than maybe the flap position indicator. Really, everything else is new. A few years ago, I had an opportunity to participate in a program, a development program, with my airplane, Garmin and Aspen were going to work together to create a digital autopilot interface between the Garmin GFC 600, you see that in the center of the panel above the engine monitor, and the Aspen PFD. And they were looking for a test bed to do the flight testing and the certification. And so I volunteered my airplane for that, and the result is what you can see here, right? That's why there's a Garmin autopilot and an Aspen PFD and three displays, a 2500 system.
And, well, I'm always a fan of mixing and matching because it keeps all the avionics companies honest and working together, and it gives you the best of everything. You get to choose the best.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, realistically, there are some limits as to what will work with what, but you know, the components you see here all work very well together, and you know, having these three Aspen units gives me redundancy. You know, if my main PFD ever goes belly up, you know, I just switch the other one into reversion mode and off I go, and I can keep flying. It also, you can see it here, gives me dedicated windows. For example, the top left is a dedicated traffic window that where at any time I know where to look if I'm worried about traffic. I don't have to switch to a different page. Yeah. Top right is weather at a glance for half the country. You know, what's going on a long flight. The redundancy and the fact that I can have all these pieces of information there all the time has been very nice.
That's awesome. I absolutely love that. And as said again, you've got a great panel, and I've always believed in, you know, choose the best of breed, make them work together. Most of the competing companies out there will do a very good job of working together. Maybe not Garmin as much, but all the other guys really, really work hard. And I appreciate that. I think it's good for all of us to have them all, you know, having the competition breeds not just price, but interoperability and features.
And absolutely, yes.
Makes it all work for us. Well, Martin, we are at the time of the show that we're going to do something that we call Social Flight's Fast Five. Are you up for that?
Let's have it.
All right, Martin, Pauly, this is your Social Flight Fast Five. Five questions that let us get to know you a little bit more about who is Martin Pauly and what made Martin Pauly the man he is today and how we all love. And so I'm going to start with question number one, which is, you've done an awful lot of flying in all sorts of different types of situations in multiple countries. Is there one favorite memory of being in the cockpit or something that happened there that that's near and dear to your heart?
Yes. It's flying through a valley in the Austrian Alps on the way home from Innsbruck. Innsbruck is an airport in the mountain valley in Austria. It was my first international flight from Germany. You know, I had to file a flight plan and go through a little more formalities. The stunning views of being surrounded by mountains on a very, very beautiful calm day. You know, not really a challenge weather-wise. I'll never forget just how beautiful that was.
That's wonderful. What kind of aircraft were you flying for that?
That was a Piper Archer or Warrior, a Cherokee. I don't remember which one exactly.
That's wonderful. I love that. Okay. Fast Five question number two. A little bit different memory. Is there a kind of scary or impactful moment at some point during your life? And it doesn't even have to be just flying, but something that that was fairly dramatic and you look back on and believe that you learned something from or it changed your life in some way?
I know exactly the scenario to bring up here. I was a glider instructor in the flying club where, you know, I originally started to learn fly gliders. I was flying with a student shortly before his first solo, and what we did there was familiarize students with stalls and also a demonstration of spins. And we did a toll to, I don't know, maybe 3,000-4,000 feet, something like that. I had walked this student through this and said, hey, the first time around, first spin, I'm going to be at the controls. I want you to feel along. It was tandem seating. I was in the back, so the student couldn't see me. I entered the spin, stick aft, full rudder. And at that moment, the control stick became undone. It came out of, you know, whatever was holding it at the bottom, the socket. And I didn't want to scare the student, you know, trying to not provoke any movements of the controls that might be counterproductive to the situation. But anyway, I walked him through the recovery and we got out of there. I found out what had happened is just before this flight, there was a passenger flight with a person, a walk-up from the neighborhood. And we always tried to accommodate those when we could. We wanted to have a good relationship with the airport neighbors and sharing the experience of flight with them was something that helped to that end. Anyway, for those flights, we usually take the control stick out if we don't know the people as a safety measure. And the stick was put back in place. There's a little wing nut at the bottom to secure it. It hadn't been tightened.
No.
So what did I learn from this? You know, every time since then, when I do the controls check, I went to the little wing nut and made sure that it was absolutely tight. And I didn't tell the student what happened until after we were back on the ground. And the expression on his face was priceless when that happened. Wow. That was, you know, nothing bad happened. Recovery went well, but that was, in all my years of flying, probably the one really scary second or two that I had, because I felt out of control. No, I was out of control, right? There was nothing I could do immediately at that moment. And fortunately, the student responded well to my verbal cues, and we're here to talk about it.
Wow. That is a really amazing story. All right. Question number three. If you could choose a moment of your life to just go and re-experience, not to change anything, just take 15 minutes and be back in that moment, what would that moment be?
Oh, I could think of many such moments, but you know, for the conversation here, I'll pick my first solo, which was in 1985 when I was 14 years old. You know, as we all continue to learn as pilots and aviators, right? We look back to our past years, our early flights, and you know, sometimes it's scary to think about how little we knew back then, right? So being able to go back to that time and see how I did on my first solo with everything I know now, I think that would be a fun time.
That's wonderful. I love that answer. That's a lot of fun. Okay, question number four, another time machine. If you could go back in time to your younger self in your teens or 20s and give a piece of advice, what would you tell your younger self?
Fly more.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah. Okay, and our last question in Social Flight's Fast Five is, if you could choose anyone at all, anyone from history, anyone living, anyone no longer with us at all, to spend an evening with, get a drink or have dinner, who would come to mind?
I've received that same question on another show a while ago, and I'll give the same answer, because you know that is probably who I really would pick, and it's Charles Lindbergh.
Huh.
you know, talking to him about his famous Atlantic crossing, what he did in preparation for it, and what he experienced during the flight. I'm sure there's a lot about it which is not known, which wasn't captured or written down in books. I would love to be able to talk to Charles Lindbergh about that.
Wonderful. Very, very cool. Well, Martin, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. Let everyone know, how do they find your channel on YouTube?
Oh, it's easy. You just open YouTube and you search for either my name, Martin Pauly, Pauly with a Y at the end, or my aircraft's tail number, November 70 Tango Bravo, and it'll take you right there.
Excellent. Well, thanks again. I hope I get to see you again in person very soon, and appreciate you joining us here this evening on Social Flight Live.
It's been fun, Jeff. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Good night.
Good night.
And to all of you, thank you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday, September 3rd, with a very special show that we have. We are doing another edition of our famous show that we have just launched, is doing so well, Cockpit to Cowl. Cockpit to Cowl is the expert tips from the cockpit and the maintenance shop. It is Brian Schiff and myself sitting there and talking about all different scenarios, topics, and questions that have to do with your flying, really putting together both perspectives. Brian is such a wonderful, amazing individual, fantastic commercial pilot and flight instructor, and I'll be bringing that side from the maintenance shop as an AMP and IA, and we have a lot of fun. So again, that is next Tuesday at this same time, Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern time, Cockpit to Cowl, and all you have to do is go to the word cockpit2cowl.com to register. It is a different show. It's not the same show as this. So be sure to register for that so you can join us there on Cockpit to Cowl. And then the following Tuesday, we are back here on Social Flight Live with Jason Miller of the Finer Points. He is so much fun, really, really a passionate educator, a wonderful human being, and someone I cannot wait for you to spend some time with. So again, I look forward to seeing you again for both of those shows. And I thank you for joining us this evening and for everything you do for general aviation. And I wish you all blue skies.